Hi, my name is Agile, and I support Gen X Grown Up through Patreon, and I believe you should too. Just go to patreon.com/GenXGrownUp.
No life, no fun. Don't you know that you're a grown up?
Gen X Grown Up is a YouTube channel, website, and audio podcast you're listening to right now. All made for and by people who love exploring media, games, tech, and toys of yesterday and today through the eyes of Gen Xers who refuse to grow up.
Your dinner cannot just be French fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown up.
Welcome back, Gen X Grown Up Podcast listener, to this backtrack edition of the Gen X Grown Up Podcast. I am John. Joining me, as always, is Mo.
Hey, everybody.
And of course, you know that George is here.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
The backtrack edition is typically where we pick a single nostalgic item and dig in deep. This is a bit of a special backtrack, though. If you're a regular listener, you may remember a few months back, George and I had a little bit of a kerfuffle. A disagreement.
Kerfuffle.
We had a discussion where I was right and you were wrong, and then we didn't agree
this
about that
exactly
part either.
This is exactly why we're having this show. Yes, right. We were talking about the current state of horror movies, and specifically we were talking about one film where there were a lot of jump scares. My criticism was the jump scares were cheap and I didn't care for them. And you're like, whoa, 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 whoa. Jump scares are critical to horror films. So ultimately what happened was, then that settled, we didn't agree on anything. But the very next episode, we got some very passionate fourth listener email. And so the initiator of that was our first guest, and that is my darling daughter, Dana, who wrote in. Hey, Dana, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
Thanks for being here. So you wrote an email into the show, and just recap what it is that you said about George's comments.
Hold on. Before you do, let me go ahead and get my Kit Kat ready.
Try to get his Halloween candy, you know? I wanted to write in because I think that George's statement is dead wrong about needing jump scares in horror films. I think that it's a blanket term for a lot of the franchise of horror movies, and I think that you can do well without them. I don't think that they're critical to make or break a horror film.
Okay, so we wanted to have Dana here as part of the debate. So I introduced my champion to the show, but she wasn't the only one that wrote in.
Yeah, no, I mean, you wanted to have Dana here.
Of course.
Had somebody else that I wanted to have here because there was another person who wrote in directly after Dana did. Our good old pal, Marcus. Marcus, welcome to the Gen X Grown Up Podcast. Thank you so much for having the correct opinion that I was right and John was wrong.
We're getting a little cocky early, aren't we?
We are. Marcus, introduce yourself to the people.
Hey, everybody. I'm Marcus. And you're right, George. You're right. That's all there is
See?
To it. You're right.
Just a few words. George, you're right. Three words. That's it.
That's it. We can stop the podcast now, I guess.
I mean, just no need for debate.
We just saved everybody 45 minutes.
No need for debate.
It's that sort of blind dogma that just really leads us down a rabbit hole, I'm afraid.
Well, Marcus, tell everybody what you said in your rebuttal email, just at least a basic summary.
I'm pretty sure I said something along the lines of a horror movie without jump scares is just a story you tell around a campfire to keep the little kids from going out at night. So I think they're essential. I think that some of the best jump scares are the ones that don't happen that you're expecting. Mm-hmm. And those happen because the jump scares happened in the first place.
Marcus even put some statistics to help back up his argument a little bit that we'll get into that when we get to that debate. But we're not just going to debate jump scares, though.
Statistics, schmatistics.
No. Don't cloud up the facts with the truth.
That's right. Now, George and I are going to do several debates about horror films and what's critical to horror films and different parts of the genre. And both Marcus and Dana are going to be the jury determining who wins. But since Marcus is George's shill and Dana is correct, we thought we might need someone.
Wow.
Lord.
Someone to break ties, right?
Yeah, so that's where I come in.
You know Marcus pays our salaries, right?
I do know that.
Yeah, I wasn't even a part of this argument at all. They were saying, I said, wait a minute, this isn't really fair because you got Dana on one side, you got Marcus on the other side. It's going to be a tie. So I said, okay, we need somebody who just truly hates horror movies so that they will be completely impartial.
Oh my word.
On decision and will just be swayed by the arguments. And I said, you know, who's the best person I could think of who absolutely hates horror movies is my daughter, Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Our unpaid intern. Hi. Yay.
Hey, Rachel. So, Rachel, what do you think of horror movies?
They're scary.
That's correct. Okay, I agree with that.
And I don't watch them.
So she is like the clean slate that you guys get to influence, because I have a feeling she's probably going to be deciding vote in a lot of these debates coming up.
Wow.
I have watched very few.
And my role here is just to facilitate.
So, Rachel, no preconceived notions about what makes a good or bad horror movie. You will be open to the debate and argument then, right?
Yeah, I've watched very, very few horror movies of any kind, and wasn't much of a fan. So,
as an example, when we were growing up, I couldn't play the X-Files theme song. Like, if it was on the TV, because she would get, like, scared.
Gave me nightmares.
Wow.
She hates horror movies. So there you go.
Of course, I was like 4, but
still. Maybe it has something to do with it. I don't know.
Creepy whistling. Get you every time.
All right. So we've got our three people. We've got our people who are going to argue. We got Mo who's going to judge. But we need one other element to this. And those are the rules. Mo,
yes.
Can you tell everybody about those?
Yes. So it's going to be very simple. We're going to start with the coin toss. Whoever wins the toss decides if they're going to go first or second. The person who goes first has 2 minutes to make their argument. Then the person will have 2 minutes to make the opposing argument. Then they'll each get a 30-second rebuttal time. After that, it goes to our jury. They will vote, and it's a winner-take-all, so it's whoever gets the majority 2 out of 3 votes wins the point for that round.
Or all 3 votes. Just prepping John in case one of you loses badly.
In the unlikely situation, it could happen. Who knows? It could be maybe one of you guys could be super persuasive and just make an amazing argument. We'll see.
Rachel, send me your PayPal, please.
Wow.
You have my email.
Fair enough.
Our jurors can't be bought, but they can be rented.
Yes, they can.
Well, I didn't say I would vote on his side, but he could send me money to try and convince me.
With that, then, I mean, we have our debaters. We have our arbiter, who is Mo. We have our jury, which is our guests, Dana, Rachel, and Marcus. If we get back from the break, we are going to get into this first debate. Stick around. Over the past few weeks, we've been trying out Factor Meals, and they're meals that come straight to your door. They deliver them to you in the mail. They drop on the front door in this freezer pack, and it's a great way to eat stress-free. And this spring, you can get delicious, ready-to-eat meals. They're fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted, and dietitian-approved. And here's the cool thing, as we've all found out. You throw them in the microwave for 2 minutes, and they're ready to eat and not even requiring cleanup.
And if you can't find something on their menu that you like, then you're just way too picky.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have over 35 options. Mm. You know, they have things like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, Vegan, Veggie, and we even tried the vegetarian one, which was really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just the regular meals, but they've also got all these add-on packs, which I really love. These are things like, you know, breakfast or on-the-go lunches or little snacks, even like beverages that want to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So really, I mean, like they say on their site, what are you waiting for? And they're not kidding. You can get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals by heading over to Factor.
Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals so you can get back to doing what you love this spring.
Are you looking for good gourmet meals? Try the meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus.
Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff.
Customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle.
Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking.
We're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for lowest carbon footprint meals.
So head to factormeals.com/GenX50 and use code GenX50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code GenX50 at factormeals.com/GenX50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Be sure to subscribe to or follow Gen X Grown Up wherever you listen. And while you're there, rate and review the show, too. It helps more than you know.
Let's hide in the attic.
No, in the basement.
Why can't we just get in the running car?
Are you crazy? Let's hide behind the chainsaws.
Smart. Yeah, okay.
If you're in a horror movie, you make poor decisions. That's what you do.
This was a good idea.
Shh, I'm being quiet.
Breathing on me.
let's get ready to rump. I mean, let's get going to debate. Yes, let's get ready to debate.
Now entering the ring.
Wait, before we start, though, I have to get my best PBS voice going here. So hold up.
Millions.
Ooh, all right.
Welcome to today's debate. My name is Mo, and I will be your host. Everyone asleep yet?
I'm basically creeped out at this point. What the hell was that voice?
Well, it's that soft, soothing kind of serial killer voice that you
had.
That's
not what that was at all.
That's creepy, Mo, is what that is. We don't want
that. Not soothed.
All right.
So good for the horror show.
Rachel is not soothed by you.
Not soothed.
You know what? No jump scare, and I'm scared.
Let's get into our first debate. The first topic that these two fine gentlemen are going to debate is finish or no finish. Now, what that means is, many, many horror movies have the open-ended ending, right? Where either the bad guy suddenly is alive or whatever, or you're left unknowing about whether the actual person is alive or dead or how it ends. And some have very definitive endings where, oh, the whole thing blew up and they killed the monster and they see pieces of it floating around, whatever. So the debate here is whether or not having an ending or having an open-ended movie is better for horror movies.
All right.
Okay. Right?
Taking the side of being ambiguous is appropriately George.
What the? Why is that appropriately,
George? Well, I agree.
Oh, no, right. George.
And no ambiguity is going to be John.
There's a definitive right way. That's right.
Yep. So, John, I'm going to have you call it. Already flipped. Okay. Heads or tails?
Tails.
Nope, it's heads. George, should I go first or second?
I'll go second.
Okay. John, when I say go, your 2 minutes will start.
All right. Fair enough.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Your 2 minutes starts now.
Okay. So I absolutely understand the reason why a horror film would want to have an ambiguous ending. And none of them are great reasons, quite honestly. I mean, maybe you want to show that the monster is supernatural. He's beyond death. Okay, maybe. Or maybe you want to make a statement about the futility of battling evil and there's no way to actually win or whatever. But I would argue that more often than not, the reason that you have that ambiguous ending, that you fake out ending, is that you're just trying to keep your franchise open for a sequel. In case it's a great success, you want to make a cash grab and jump in and do a second one and a third one. But I would argue that's not necessary. And in fact, it's damaging. What happens is when you have that fake out ending, you completely negate everything the protagonist has done the entire film. So like all the terror they endured, all the bravery that they showed, the sacrifice of the characters that didn't even make it was for nothing. The way it started was the way that ended. The evil or the monster or the bad guy or the shape or whatever it is still out there. Nothing has changed and nothing got accomplished. It's kind of just pushing that big reset button, so the whole thing was null and void. I would argue we deal with enough unbeatable terror and unsurmountable evil in the real world, so when we go to the realm of the horror film for escape, it's better when our champion, who is basically our avatar in the movie, that our champion's blood, sweat, and tears amount to something and actually pay off. And that doesn't mean you have to have a happy ending. In each Conjuring film, for example, the main evil entity is defeated without a psych-out ending, but evil, and I'm talking here about evil with a capital E, still exists in the world. There's still room for sequels or for continuing the story or to have follow-ups without disrespecting the sacrifices of the characters in the film. So while you can have overarching themes, there's no reason to nullify all of the work of the characters in the film. Fake out endings are absolutely horrible.
That's your 2 minutes. You made some very good points there. So let's turn it over to George. Are you ready, sir?
I believe I am ready. Now that you and John have decided already, you know, between the two of you, that you like John before I even get to speak.
No, I just said he made some good points. I'm sure
you will too.
Yeah,
that's not your job, Mr. Judge.
You can too. We don't mind.
That's right. But I don't get a vote, so it doesn't matter what I think. Okay, George, you ready? Your time starts now.
Yeah, so I'm going to start off in a different direction than John did. John talked about gut feelings, and all of that's important, and I'm not saying it's not, but let's go with some statistics. First of all, let's talk about some highly rated films with completely ambiguous endings. A Quiet Place, 96% on Rotten Tomatoes. At the end of that film, you have no idea what's going to happen with the creatures. They killed one. Are they going to kill a whole bunch of other ones? Are they going to save humankind? Are they going to go, you know, and be able to reuse or amplify that weapon? You have no idea. Another one, Silence of the Lambs, 96%. Dr. Lecter escaped at the end of that film and was apparently going to kill his tormentor slash psychologist. You have no idea what happens to him. You have no idea if Clarice is going to go on to bigger and better things, if he's going to come back and kill her. You're really not sure. Another one, Cabin in the Woods, 92% Rotten Tomatoes. Evil returns to the Earth after all the protagonists that John was talking about fail in their mission to subdue the evil. I think it also is beneficial to allow a story to move on past just one film. Let's talk about Halloween, one of the greatest horror films of all time. Michael Myers disappears at the end, and that allows you to have Halloween 2 and the more recent Halloween films like Halloween Kills that just came out. Friday the 13th, Jason pops up from the water. That's one of the most iconic scenes in all of horror history, and that's an ambiguous ending. Nightmare on Elm Street. There were so many different endings shot for that film that they weren't even sure that they got the right ending on for the preview for the studio to buy the film in the first place. Alien, the ending was closed, so they had to rework it into Aliens so that they could have a second film because they needed an ambiguous
and
ending
that
they didn't give it.
Thank you. Okay.
I just want to point out on video, though, Dana's giving me the cut off stuff like she hates my debate before I even get finished with that. Some bullshit prejudice.
I got some questions, comments, and concerns about that.
You'll have time to speak later. George made some interesting points there as well. So now we're going to go to the rebuttal phase. So, John, you have 30 seconds. Are you ready?
Sure, I guess so.
Okay, your time starts now.
So I understand the arguments that George is making, and I appreciate that he's saying, hey, these were highly rated films. But rather than analyzing for himself what makes a great horror movie, he's letting the critics and the box office determine for him what it is that he thinks makes a great horror film. I assert that storytelling goes well beyond anything that you might see in the box office or in critics. In fact, what makes a great horror movie is a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Someone has grown and something
and
has changed.
Time. Okay. George?
Yeah.
Are you ready?
I believe I am ready.
Okay. Your 30 seconds starts now.
Yeah. So John is right. I did take a look at the opinions of the multitude of the horror fan universe to make my decision on whether or not an ambiguous ending was proper or a final ending was proper. John is taking only his opinion of what makes a horror film ending proper, ambiguous or final. I think that it's more correct to listen to the larger audience to determine which is the correct way to go
and
with a horror
film. Your time. Very good.
Okay.
So there we go. You heard some really great arguments. So now we're going to turn it over to the jury. And I would remind John and George that they have to keep quiet while they deliberate.
Good luck. Well, of course, we have to keep quiet now. John's only been prepping Dana for the last 2 weeks on this.
So jury, just say you're ready to tell me the vote, and then we'll continue from there.
All right.
Okay. And with that, I will turn it over to our jury.
Well, Dana had some strong opinions, you could tell from the video. Couldn't tell from my video because I don't have it going right now, but I've got some also. I'll let you go first, though.
Cool. Thank you, George, for the riveting statistics and information that you gathered through IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes. However, I would like to go ahead and state that one of your examples is completely false. Cabin in the Woods does have a very final ending.
Oh.
The main characteristics of a horror movie, you have the monster dies, everyone lives, the monster dies. The people who were trying to survive most definitely did not survive. We have a finality in that. Evil rose up, they died. That was how that movie ended. So no thank you to that one. For your Halloween franchise,
so
you are correct. For the Halloween franchise,
why the hell is she attacking
George? Hey. Let the women speak, man.
Bullshit.
Can we mute his microphone, please?
Invite me on the show just to interrupt me.
Damn it, George, you're embarrassing us in public.
I'm sorry, Marcus.
Dana, continue.
Thank you so much, Mo. For the Halloween franchise, you are right in that there is no finality in it. And you talked about how it sets it up for every other Halloween movie. However, consider how many of those Halloween movies in that Halloween franchise were actually good and how many of them have just ebbed into, yes, we know that Michael Myers is going to continue living. It is just going to be another $25 out of my pocket to go and watch him just kill people for an hour and a half.
Okay.
And it stops being scary because you know exactly what's going to happen every single time. The monster will not be stopped. It's started to ebb into almost the Saw franchise in that way, in that it becomes very murder porn in that sense, in a way that you know exactly what's going to happen. It's just how he's going to do it and when he's going to do it.
So I'm going to say a couple things.
Okay.
One is, I am scared of Michael Myers. I saw that movie when I was 8. When he got up at the end of that movie, I was convinced when I got home, he was in the closet. I just knew Michael was going to get me. I'm 49 years old. And when I look down a dark hallway where the light ends, I know that about 6 inches past that, Michael is standing. That scared the hell out of me. I don't agree that a movie has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. I think the ambiguous nature of like that thing where he got up, let the story go on. So the story going on and me being scared later was way more important than what happened in the little hour and a half time frame that they show on the film. So setting it up so that I've got a reaction even afterwards, I think is a big deal. I don't agree that the protagonist is necessarily our avatar, but two, if they all die off, sometimes I don't care, but I could be scared of whatever that monster is, and I can live for 40 more years being scared of that monster, and I am.
Okay, so I don't think George did himself the best service by mentioning some of the worst continuing franchises of all time.
I think that's probably true.
Because I've seen some of the later Halloween movies, and they were not scary. They were just bad.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That is true.
I think that was just dragging something out for money's sake and not actually for good movie making sake. Like, even in the newer ones, it just, yes, they brought Jamie Lee Curtis back, but it doesn't mean it's a good movie since it's like the 40th one.
Pardon me for mentioning it. I was going to say the only way that George could have butchered it even worse is by saying that it was going to be Paranormal Activity as the non-finality movies. Like,
honestly, I think if he had gone for more artsy, cerebrally horror movies that have an open ending.
Cerebrally,
technical term there.
I love it.
That had an open ending, I would have been more on his side on that one. I just think you picked bad references.
Yeah. Like, if you want to talk about a good movie that has a very open-ended, I would have said It Follows was a very good open-ended. Like, it's going to keep going no matter what, but it still had a sense of, like, this story itself has closed, but the evil is still ongoing. And that in itself is terrifying because there is no way to stop it. Unlike if you have a killer where there may be a possibility to end it in the future, that particular thing is beyond human comprehension and is going to continue whether you like it or not until the world explodes.
So in this trilogy that they're doing for Halloween now, obviously, if there's a trilogy, Mike's not going to die in one or two. There's going to be a third movie. There is something to be said for chapters, I think, at some point.
But back to what Marcus said about, like, Michael Myers waiting in the wings for him. Like, I think you could get that on a movie that just ended, too. Like, It. I watched the first half of It. Couldn't watch the second half. I know it ends, but I was still afraid of Pennywise the Clown climbing his creepy-ass face over my bed, you know?
Right, right. I don't disagree with that, necessarily.
So I don't think the continuation of the monster really has anything to do with how the ending goes.
For that particular monster, it did for me. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Also, Marcus, okay. You said you were, like, 8. So, like, I feel like the standing on how scary it's going to be, you've got that embedded in your brain that Michael Myers is one scary motherfucker.
Oh, I do.
You have a nostalgia factor there.
Yeah, it's the nostalgia factor. I feel like if you were to pick up that movie in your 20s, in your 30s, in your 40s for the first time, and they're like, we're about to make 5 more movies about this bad boy, and you're like, oh my God, please don't.
Fucking millennials.
It'd be like us watching Twilight again.
Oh, Lord.
It sounds like you guys have finished your deliberations. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll go around the room. So we'll start with Dana. How do you vote?
I absolutely am voting on John's side. I do believe in finding the finality of a movie. I think it makes it a lot more enjoyable in the end to know that the story is closed and that we know exactly who the winner is in this horror thriller that we're watching.
Okay. Marcus?
I am going to vote George's position because I completely believe the idea that the monster still might be out there for me is something that is a big deal. I think that's part of the experience.
Okay. So one vote George, one vote John. Rachel?
Is this how it's going to be the whole time?
I'm
going to
have to piss
somebody off. Okay. I'm voting on John's side because I don't think George argued his point well enough. I think there are ways it could have gone that I could have voted George's side. I just don't think he picked the right movies to go on.
I would also like to mention, I adored that when Marcus said, I am voting on George. George looked so baffled to get a point right there. That was crazy. He was like, oh my God, seriously?
It's only the first round. I'm sorry you picked the worst franchises.
Oh no.
I think it's bullshit that those are the worst franchises. If it weren't for those franchises, you little millennial assholes wouldn't have horror movies now.
Wow. Rachel, are you trying to go on strike?
I mean, they don't don't pay me anyway. There's no strike.
Way to endear yourself to the jury. Holy moly.
Okay, order, 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 order. With that, John wins the first debate.
Gonna get okay, boomer. What the hell, George? You're embarrassing us in public.
Damn okay. It. Sorry, Marcus.
So John wins the first debate, and when we come back, we'll go on to our second topic.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book. And together, we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our ninth season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Gen X Grown Up. But if you have a friend who's not yet listening, why not? Tell them about us. They'll thank you later.
Oh, I do enjoy an evening with a little light entertainment. But when your video heads get dirty, you lose your picture. Not a pretty sight. Happily, this new Polaroid video cassette will help you. It actually cleans your heads as it plays, so dirty heads needn't haunt you. New Polaroid video cassettes. Get the picture?
Welcome back, everybody. So now we are going on to our second debate topic, and this topic is on the use of gore in a horror movie. Mm. Is it good? Is it bad? Now, for Gen Xers like us growing up, you know that when they first started doing like real gore, like the stuff that you see, like intestines come out, that blew us away because you didn't see anything like that. But now it's almost commonplace. The debate is going to be whether or not gore is essential for a horror film. On this one, we have George is going to be taking the side of gore is not essential, and John will be taking the side of you have to have lots of gore, otherwise why make the movie?
Paraphrasing, but yeah, fair enough.
So last time, John went first, so George, you're going to go first. Are you ready, sir?
No, not at all. I right now, I feel defeated before I even start.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, let's go ahead and start.
Okay, your time starts now.
All right. First of all, the reason why gore is not essential to a horror film is the fact that there is a gore subgenre of horror films, showing that you can have plenty of other genres of horror films that have no gore in them whatsoever. As an example, a movie that I mentioned in the previous debate that didn't get a lot of love, apparently, A Quiet Place. Alien, you barely even see the creature until the last segment of the film. Psycho, the knife never touches the body in the shower stabbing scene at the beginning of the film. Blair Witch Project, again, it's just three kids running around in some woods. But I think it's a great film because it builds a lot of intense emotions. Now, I'm looking at all of these films and talking about them during the time that they were released, not with rose-colored glasses now, looking back on the films that have come since then. The Ring, creepy as hell, almost no gore. There was just that weird, creepy girl coming out of the screen. And I think it's important to note that it's more about intensity and suspense and pulling that rubber band taut until it snaps with the audience's emotions. When you can do that, you don't have to show blood. You don't have to show guts. You don't have to be Tom Savini pulling guts out of Dawn of the Dead actors in a mall. You really only have to keep the audience on the edge of their seats, gripping tight onto their armrests to give them that essential horror movie experience. And I think that the fact that there is a subgenre completely dedicated to gore porn and horror porn with gore and all that, whatever they want to call it, things like Saw and Hostel and those types of movies, I think that they have to belong in their own subgenre is evidence enough that you don't have to have gore in a horror movie in order for it to be successful.
Okay. And your time. Good. All right. John, are you ready, sir? Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Yep. Your time starts now.
All right. Now, George asserted that because gore and that kind of horror is a subgenre, that the debate topic is moot and there's no way that I can win. But even though a horror film does not have to have gore, I'm going to continue to assert why you should, and it makes it better. For me, blood and gore in horror films is part and parcel with the escapism nature of the genre. It's not unlike a video game where I want to go and just shoot some guys in the head with a sniper rifle. It's not that I would ever do that in real life, but that's part of the escapism of cinema. It satisfies a fantasy. You know, seeing that knife cut through a victim's flesh, we know it's fake. We're not monsters. We're not trying to hurt anybody. But good horror can transport you to a different world and a different mindset. And gore contributes to that. You can live vicariously through experience and danger without being in actual danger. And seeing the tangible result of danger and violence makes it more exciting. You know, when Jason pushes that arrow through Kevin Bacon's throat in Friday the 13th, it just drives home how high the stakes are. It's not left your imagination to wonder, you know, just how dangerous our killer is. You know firsthand, he's bloodthirsty. He has disregard for the life of his victims. It's visceral, and it suggesting it off-screen does not give you that same visceral sense. This transgresses the norms of what's acceptable and allows the viewer to break through into that fantasy world and experience the terror just the way the filmmaker intended, not just suggest it, to show you. And finally, gore is real. Blood and guts are real. What the FCC and decency commissions over the last 100 years have done to sterilize entertainment and not allow creators to show the impact of trauma on the human body, too much gore and you get an R, an NC-17 to hurt your bottom line. But people, human beings, are fragile creatures. And putting that front and center on display might be shocking to some people, but death's part of life. Often very messy. Death is very messy. Gore in horror films is done with special effects, but it truly represents the human experience and, in fact, the end of the human experience.
And that's your time, sir. Now we're going on to our 30-second rebuttal period. George, are you ready, sir?
I need like a minute and a half, but I'll take the 30 seconds you give me.
Okay, you get 30 seconds. These are rules that we were agreed upon. Okay, your time starts now.
So the fact that John is stating that we need gore to escape completely nullifies every horror film that doesn't show gore, which I don't think he intends to do. John and I have both talked many a time that Alien is a great sci-fi horror film. There's no gore in that one. I mean, I know he's a big fan of Psycho. Psycho is a film that has no gore in it whatsoever. I think that you don't have to use it to transport yourself. I think it is just an effect that can be used, and that's the difference.
Sir. Okay, John, are you ready?
Okay.
Okay, your time starts now.
I would argue that I'm no more nullifying those other films that don't have gore than George is trying to nullify the entire topic of this debate. Yes, gore does not have to be in every single film, but where it is applicable, where a film could have gore, erring on the side of showing it contributes more to the escaping into the fantasy of horror than it does if you just suggest it. Gore, where useful, where appropriate, and use it is absolutely vital to get the point across in horror.
That's your time. Okay. So there we go. We have the two arguments. Jury, you may start your deliberations.
I thought it was funny that George busted out with pulling the rubber band taut, which I wrote down because I thought it was pretty cool. And then John read the like last 2 minutes of his debate on the topic. It's like you could tell he was reading from something or had to memorize something. But I don't know why I thought that was funny. It was just funny to me that George said something I thought was, oh, that's really cool. And then John had a soliloquy of things that you could tell that was a little more prepared. That was cool.
So you ready to vote?
I have opinions on this, but I don't think the debate was pretty straightforward to me. You either need it or don't. I don't think
it was well argued on both sides. I'll
yeah,
say.
That's what I, that's. I sure. guess that's what I'm saying.
Definitely very well argued on both sides.
I really thought John's point of not shying away from gore when it's kind of set up for you, I thought that was a good point that he made. Mm-hmm. Not shying away from it necessarily. That was a good point. I'm not sure that the politically correct argument, either one way or the other, or politically incorrect argument, really had much of a bearing about whether or not the standards boards or whatever made them ours. I'm not sure that really factored into how I feel about it. But I do believe that you don't necessarily need to shy away from it.
But on George's side of it, I like that whole growing up, my dad always said, when I was wanting to shy away or not look at something, that your imagination will always be worse.
That's true. That can be true, I should say.
In that aspect of it, I kind of like that point of it, that gore is not necessary, really, because your mind can make up things way worse than they can do. And sometimes I find gore in movies, it's not scary. It doesn't really have a lot of impact. A lot of these movies are gore for gore's sake. And it's kind of
funny. It's campy sometimes. Yeah, it's campy, right? Sometimes the gore, they try so hard that it comes off a little campy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
I find some gore takes away from the movie.
I think some movies are definitely shaped to have gore be the reason of the horror movie, which, again, like we mentioned, how George mentioned, like, Saw is explicitly just gore porn. You know that someone's going to get hurt. It's the basis of the movie. And that can be frightening in itself. That may be why a lot of people watch it, is because that can be scary to them. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it can either just be way overstimulating, or it can just become very stale. I feel like it has to be peppered into the point that it feels like it matters to you, or maybe that it feels more realistic. I think the movie Midsommar, which I don't know if you guys have watched Midsommar.
Oh my God.
Sorry.
Marcus loves it.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Marcus, do you have comments about Midsommar?
Oh, well, that has many, many comments. Oh, that would detract from the argument, though. What you're saying.
I think Midsommar is a good example of exaggerating gore. It doesn't have a lot of gore, but in some of the few scenes that it does have gore, it really tries to bank on you should be terrified of this one thing. And it flashes that on the screen so many times to the point that I was like, I get it, I understand it, but it's unnecessary. You didn't need to show me that. I could only, if you would just show me the suggestion of it. Hereditary does a really good job of that, of you not being able to see a lot of the scary stuff, including the stuff that could be mutilation, self-mutilation, anything of that sort. You don't have to see the thing to understand the implication of it. And that by itself is very scary. Movies that do that can be a lot scarier because it leads your imagination to assume the worst without you even having to see how scary it really can be.
Okay. I had no clue that nonsense of Midsommar was supposed to be a horror movie.
You just walked into that like, wow, this is a really cool camping movie. How'd you guys bring me?
No, what I walked into it was John and his daughter won't take me to some crazy nonsense movie. I was wrong.
Hey, if it makes you feel any better, I didn't know anything about the movie either. I didn't watch a trailer. John just said, do you want to go see a movie? It's supposed to be a scary movie. I said, yeah, whatever. And I walked in and then I endured it for 2 hours.
Oh my gosh. That is the closest I've ever come to punching John. If I was sure I could take him, I might have.
I think you and I have very opposite opinions of that movie, because I didn't care for it very much. In terms of horror movie standards, it was kind of mid-tier for me. I didn't care for it very much, but I know a lot of other people have some very strong emotions about how it made them feel. It felt like it derailed itself quite a bit on the theme.
Oh, so does Marcus has some strong opinions about how it made him feel.
I bet
too.
He does.
Oh my God.
So are you guys ready to vote?
Yeah. I think I am. Yeah. Okay. Dana?
Yeah.
We'll search up the order a little bit. So, okay. Rachel, we're going to start with you this time.
Oh, geez. Okay. Starting with your swing vote first there. Honestly, I'm going to go on George's side with this, because I think gore is not necessary. When I hear gore, I think things like Final Destination, which I don't think is a horror movie.
Okay.
It's supposed to be, but the excessive gore makes it funny.
I got to run the table now, George. It's tough.
Well, you're not going to.
Hold on. Let me get this Kit Kat out.
Marcus, what is your vote?
The gore is not necessary. It's not necessary. It's fine that it's there. It's not necessary.
Okay. Dana.
I am unfortunately also going to be swinging the side of George. I agree that gore does not have to be necessary to make a horror film good.
Okay. Well, there we go. Clean sweep for George.
Your own daughter, John. Your own daughter.
Does that Kit Kat taste like victory, George?
It does.
It is unpleasant it like watching George
tears.
Sweet, sweet victory.
I hope you choke. Okay.
So there we go. So George, very decisive victory on this second debate. And when we come back, we'll come to our third and final debate.
Hip Pass Moto, sponsored by Moto America, is the show that keeps you up to speed on the latest in motorcycling and brings the biggest names in motorcycle racing right to you. From candid interviews with the top names in racing to providing insights into the trends and trendsetters driving the motorcycle industry, we have you covered. New episodes are available every Thursday at pitpassmoto.com and on your favorite podcast app. Ride on!
Each episode of Gen X Grown Up has show notes loaded with links where you can learn more about our topics. And there's even more to see and hear over at genxgrownup.com.
There's a vacancy at the Bates Motel.
Norman, is that you?
Now it's
Buzz McKenzie, and it could be you. Look for this display and enter Bud Light Psycho Sweepstakes to win a Bud Light party with Spud McKenzie at the Psycho Mansion. You could even get a mug like Spud's at participating retailers. Wow!
That Spud's is so cool, it's scary.
This is it. The main event. This is the argument started it all.
At least he's not doing the creepy PBS voice.
Yeah, that was just creepy to me.
Thankful for that, certainly.
Yeah, see, there you go. This is the debate that started this whole topic, this whole discussion, this whole podcast, which is jump scares. Are they an essential part of a horror movie, or are they not an essential part of a horror movie? Now, we do know that Dana and Marcus have some strong opinions on this, as do George and John, but to test here, see whether or not they can convince somebody to their side and maybe swing a vote. We're going to do another coin toss and see who goes first. George, call it.
Heads.
It is heads, sir. Do you want to go first or second?
I will go second.
Okay. So So John is taking the position of jump scares are not essential for a horror movie.
Not essential. Yep.
And George is taking the point of jump scares are essential for a horror movie. So, John, are you ready, sir?
Okay. Main event. Get ready. All right.
Okay.
I'm ready.
Time starts now.
Quality, meaningful horror films require craft and skill. They're built on a story that's all about ratcheting up the tension. You know something's going to happen. It's imminent, and you're waiting for it. Your pulse quickens. Maybe you cover your eyes. And whether the thing you're dreading happens or is postponed, it leaves a lasting impact. Jump scares, on the other hand, are lazy bullshit. I'm sick of the shot in the bathroom mirror where you close the vanity and the bad guy's behind you. I'm sick of the black cat leaping in the window. That's cheap. Or the camera that follows you under the bed. And then when you stand up, the bad guy's behind you. Look, the excitement derived from that is momentary and fleeting. It's a cheap scare. By contrast, that excitement from the slow, ominous anticipation is palpable and lingering. Halloween, for example, you know Michael is there, ducking in and out of bushes or doorways. You're on the edge of your seat with anticipation. Sinister, Bagul doesn't jump out at you. His presence is seen in shadows and reflections, but not leaping out at you. It's all in Sinister. Hereditary, that Dana mentioned in her deliberations. Very deliberate, very creepy. The scene where the woman is climbing the walls like a spider, proceeding to saw her own head off. No jump scares there. Conjuring, sure, they have some jump scares, but the dread the film creates is not relying on that mechanism. It's character driven. It Follows, another great film from 2014 that Dana also mentioned. The entity is literally always walking toward you. You can see it in the distance, whatever form it's taken. It doesn't mean it has to be surprises. A horror film can be full of true tension and anxiety, including jump scares. That's fine. A horror film can be full of true tension and anxiety with no jump scares, and that's even better. But a horror film that relies entirely on jump scares to create any sense of fear is schlock and not worth your time and is an insult to the horror genre.
Okay, this is time. George, are you ready, sir?
I'm going to stretch this out a little bit. Let me think.
That's what she said.
Okay. Why would she say that? Why would she say that?
You would know.
Why would I know?
Okay, so George, your time starts now.
Okay, so there are three essential tenets of all horror films. First one is evil. You need to have some form of evil in order for it to be a horror film, because that's what makes it horrible. Something that's bad, something that tries to hurt the protagonist, or something that tries to end the world, whatever you may say. One of the other ones that you really need to have, I think, is suspense. You need to have tension. That rubber band moment that I mentioned earlier, where you stretch that tension for the audience out as far as that rubber band can stretch. And then what's the one thing that snaps that rubber band and gives you that fright? It's a damn jump scare. I don't care if you think that you don't like them anymore. The fact is, jump scares are an essential part of the horror film experience. If you don't have jump scares, you simply don't really have a horror movie. You look at something like Antebellum. In that one, according to wheresthejump.com, there are two jump scares. There's no damn way Antebellum is considered a genuine serious horror film by any stretch of the imagination. You look at something like Jaws the Revenge, three jump scares in that piece of crap movie from the 80s. I don't think it even made it in the 90s because that shark shouldn't swim that far. You look at some other films, though, that have great jump scare moments. Insidious, 24 jump scares. It's rated one of the highest rank scare films by heart rate, according to AtomicTickets.com. Right there below it, The Conjuring number 2, which is exactly where this debate started, because John and Dana said that The Conjuring 2 was the best one of the films, and it has the most jump scares of all the Conjuring films.
Time's up. Time is up. Okay. Now we're going to rebuttal phase. John, are you ready?
Give me just 1 second. Update my note. Okay. I think I'm fine.
Okay. Your 30 seconds starts now.
George laid out 3 points that are required for a horror film. Evil. Absolutely, we need evil. Evil doesn't have to jump out and scare you. Evil is malevolent and always present. Suspense does not have to jump out and scare you. It is always omnipresent and it creates that drama. You can have both of those without a jump scare and have a horror movie. If you have jump scares without that, you have garbage. He pointed out Antebellum and Jaws that are horrible horror movies. They relied on jump scares, just 2 or 3, and they were trash. You need pure, good filmmaking to make a horror, not something jumping out of a fucking cabinet.
Okay, that's your time. George, are you ready?
I believe I am.
Okay, your time starts now.
Well, thank you, John, for making my point for me. You said those relied on jump scares. If they relied on jump scares for an hour and a half to only have 2 or 3 of them in the entire film, that proves my point that you need more jump scares in order to make it a better horror movie. That's why The Conjuring 2 has 22 jump scares in it. You need the antithesis of the tension, which is the snapback of the rubber band. That is the jump scare. It is essential to horror films.
Okay, 2 very good arguments made. Let's turn it over to the jury. You guys can start your deliberations.
I feel like if I vote on this either way, I'm going to die.
Say, John's got his teeth showing.
I have opinions on this one, actually.
Go ahead.
So I'm the person jump scares are geared to. I'm the screaming one. I'm the hiding behind the pillow. I'm the person that jump scares are geared towards to add that kind of fear. But I also think that, you know, I don't know. I don't think there needs to be 22 jump scares. Like The Haunting of Hill House, I actually did watch. It got recommended to me way too many times that I didn't. And it was really good. And there was one solid jump scare in it. One. But in a way, that's what I remember the most is that jump scare from the whole. It kind of colored my entire view of the whole show. So I don't know. I'd say it was necessary. I don't think there needs to be 22. But I guess, I don't know, I kind of think they're important, different kinds of fear.
So I agree there don't need to be 22. I feel like, and I said it, you know, sarcastically in the email, but I really do feel like that if without the jump scares, you've got a suspense movie, which isn't necessarily a horror movie, right? And so that's kind of my feeling about it. If you don't have a jump scare where I actually physically jump and go, whoa, then I haven't seen a horror movie. I've seen a suspense movie where I've got that feeling of dread that's long lasting, that builds up and builds up and builds up, and there's no release, right? It's just I've got this consistent feeling of dread, danger, suspense. And it's to me, it's a suspense movie. Without the jump scares, it's not horror to me. I understand other people can have it long lasting. And I kind of agree with what Rachel said. The jump scares often are what you remember in some of these movies. Oftentimes because you laugh at yourself because it was nothing. And they absolutely can be overdone. And there are tropes where you close the mirror and the guy's standing behind you, you go under the bed. Like John said, they're tropes and they can be done poorly, but because they're done poorly sometimes doesn't mean that they're not necessary. And I believe for a good movie, a good jump scare or two are required. A bad jump scare, maybe not required, but a jump scare that's a good one is required for a horror movie, in my opinion.
I think that we kind of all have the same similar thought process of, yes, jump scares can exist in horror. However, the best jump scares are hardly going to be the ones that you're going to see in films like Paranormal Activity or any of those other kind of run-on franchises or spin-off movies where you see one scary thing and then it just kind of trails off. Those things are going to be those really tacky ones that you just can't, you can't avoid them, and they feel like they belittle the quality of the movie. It's going to be the ones that we want where the tension alone is going to scare you more than knowing what's coming. Just like how John talked about with Michael Myers. You know where Michael Myers is. You know he's behind you. You know that he's still coming. He's still advancing on you. It's going to be like that the entire time. It's just a matter of, you know, when is the monster going to get to the protagonist? When is the girl going to get her head knocked off clean? When is this person going to get run over by a lawn? lawnmower, because we know it's going to happen. The scene's going on for too long, and that by itself is enough to terrify me. I know what's coming, but it's going to be the tension that it brings. It doesn't have to be the man standing behind me with the ambiance noise and the loud screaming. It's going to be the emotion that just that one scene brings, building up to that moment of the jump scare. And I'm not sure if you can 100% count that as a jump scare if it's not the same tone. It's not going to be one of those, oh, the phone was just ringing in the background and that's what startles us out of our...
Well, it's like you're like hypnotized by what's coming. You're,
yeah,
you got you're the in anticipation that zone. And you're in the zone and you're like, when's it happening? When's it happening? When's it happening?
You're so tense waiting for something to happen. It's got that eerie music and it's coming, it's coming.
Yeah.
And then the phone rings or a friendly neighbor knocks on the mm-hmm. door to check on you, and that's supposed to be considered a jump scare. And while that should be like, oh, they're luring you into a false sense of security, you won't know what's coming next, it doesn't make me feel that way. It feels like it lowers the quality of what I'm watching, because you felt the need to just tack on these nonsensical things into your horror movie to try and make it seem scarier when it didn't need that filler. I want to see the actual scary things rather than your poor attempt to make a jump scare.
I can't agree that jump scares are overdone.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't make them unnecessary.
Right. So like the Halloween 2018 movie starts off with the reporters going to see Michael at the asylum. And they go to the asylum. The guy has his mask. He pulls it out and he holds it up. And the wind starts blowing as soon as the mask comes out of the bag. And birds start going crazy. The dogs start going crazy. The other people around Michael start going crazy. He's standing a little too close to Michael. The guy told him, don't get close to the line. The music's getting louder. Everything's getting louder. Everything's getting tense. And you just know Michael's going to snap his arm off and beat him with it and take that mask. And then just at the crescendo of everything going on, it goes to black and the Halloween logo comes up. It's a jump scare that doesn't happen. It's like the anticipation for that jump scare couldn't be there without other jump scares that you know happen. It's the missing jump scare sometimes is the best part of it, right? Nobody jumped when it went to black. You kind of laughed at yourself because you just were just sitting there at the edge of your seat waiting for Michael to grab that guy. And that's how this new trilogy was going to start. And it didn't. And, you know, later he gets the guy and hands the teeth to the woman under the bathroom stall. But at that moment, he got away with it. And you just knew that that was coming. So to me, even the jump scares that don't happen are important, and they can only happen with the stupid ones that are the cat, where you kind of laugh at yourself, and absolutely can be overdone. But I think that is there again, it's essential to have that jump to me for a horror movie. You know, I didn't get swayed, I guess is probably where this is going to go.
I think that jump scares can make a lot of good situations in a horror movie. But if a horror film, thriller film can make a horror movie that doesn't have jump scares, that is an incredible feat by not using that same technique, because you are using fear that is beyond the loud noises and things that we'd usually react to. If you can get the same kind of fear out of me just by the environment that you've created, I think that that is 10 times more palpable than it would be shoving it in my face.
Both the arguments were really good. Like, this is a difficult one.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you guys finished deliberations? Are you ready to vote?
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay. I think so.
Let's change the order. So we're going to start with you, Marcus, this time.
I still think you need jump scares. Jump scares are important to horror movies.
Okay. So you're voting for George that jump scares are essential for horror movies.
They are. Yes.
Okay. Dana.
I am going to continue on my stance. I have not changed that. I do not believe that jump scares are a necessity in horror and shouldn't be a necessity for a lot of situations.
Well, it's 1-1. Comes down to you, Rachel.
I hate this.
just be honest and give your honest opinion.
Just decide who you like more, you know.
No.
Son of a pus bucket.
God.
No. Purely based off the argument, I think jump scares are necessary.
And why is that? What was it about the argument that swayed you?
I think
you?
They're overdone, but I think different levels of fear are important in a horror movie.
I cannot believe this.
The sound of George opening another Kit Kat of victory.
Yes.
I think they're needed, you know, because there's the suspense, there's the buildup, there's that quick, and then there's the long-term fear after the movie of, is Pennywise going to crawl up my bed? You know? I think they're needed. Sorry.
Well, there we have it, everybody. George wins the debate. Wow.
That's what I got to say about that shit, too.
I guess they're looking for a new unpaid intern, and I will be putting my resume out to other podcasts.
We're going
to
start charging you.
I'm going to get you paid. I'm the one in charge of the money.
You won. I voted for you twice.
That's what I'm saying. I'm giving you the money. You're going to be paid intern now.
Now if you lost, that'd be a different story.
Right.
You've got questions, we've got answers. Business leadership, ownership, and sales can be challenging. Tune into the Accelerate Your Business Growth podcast to learn from the world's experts. Join me, your host, Diane Helbig, as I chat with people who have expertise in various areas of business. You'll enjoy the lively conversations that are focused on providing you with the ideas, tips, and suggestions you need to realize greater success. Get what you need for your business when you need it from the people who have the answers. Accelerate Your Business Growth is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
If you're a diehard Gen X grown-up, you can pledge your support by clicking Join on YouTube or by becoming a patron at genxgrownup.com/Patreon.
I'm Freddy Krueger, and you're invited to my special get-together. But beware, you may never leave. Dial this number now. I've got some grisly details for you. And if you're one of my lucky callers selected at random, you'll talk to me live while you're awake and safe. So dial this number now if you dare. Talk to me live. Freddy Krueger is waiting just for you.
$2 for the first minute, 35 cents each additional minute.
Let me be the first to be magnanimous in defeat and congratulate you, George. You see that you're you're chewing on your damn Kit Kat of victory. I know.
I got another one. Hold on.
Oh my God. Just keep stuffing your face with your victory candy. I love how these went because I felt in a lot of ways that, George, you and I debated, and then the jury did their own internal debate based on what we said with their own opinions, too. They brought their own life experience into it.
Yeah, I was biting my tongue so often because I wanted to get in there and argue with the debate having amongst themselves. Right. They were all making good points that sometimes I wished I had brought up in my own debates. Like, and especially that last one, John and I were typing back and forth in Discord just between each other about, oh, this is what I should have said here. That's what I should have said there. You guys did a great job of bringing an extra element into the debate podcast. We've had these plenty of times before and they've been fun, but this was super fun.
So I want to quickly go around and talk to each of you just about this experience and what your takeaway is from this. And I would like to start with you, Rachel, as the swing vote. You were probably under the most pressure many times. You were,
yes.
There was almost an expectation that it was going to be this bilateral thing, and then you're going to have to be the swing vote. You did that in two of the cases, of course. So how did you feel about this experience? Any takeaways from this? Any changing of your opinions about horror films?
I mean, it was fun. I did not know most of the movies you and Dana were talking about.
Fair.
That you had mentioned. Yeah. I have seen none of them. I've seen one Halloween movie, Haunting of Hill House, half of It.
Gotcha.
And that's about all of my experience, but I don't know. It was fun.
Okay.
Your arguments were good.
George did a great job. I really enjoyed it. I didn't write any rebuttals. I built my rebuttals off of what George said, and I think he did the same for me.
You can't write a rebuttal. You have to listen to the person you're against so that you can pick apart the points that they just made. That's the whole point.
So let me turn to you, Dana. So any takeaways from this? You change any of your minds or have any new outlook on any of these tropes in horror movies? What was your experience here? Any takeaways?
I've always been pretty firm in my standing on horror films. I'm very picky with my taste of horror films. You know that anytime you try and invite me out somewhere, you're like, oh, this one looks really good. And I'm like, I don't know about that, man. It seems tacky or this seems tacky. So I was pretty strict on what I already had in mind going into it. I think that George definitely had a lot of good opinions to bring up, bar a lot of the statistics. I don't want to hear the statistics. I want to hear what you think. I could also open up Rotten Tomatoes. I want to hear your opinion about it.
Well, that's my old debate background coming out, because debate starts with statistics.
With facts,
so whenever you go to see one, it's all about provable, verifiable facts.
Yeah.
There's actually a rule that if you proffer a fact that turns out to be false, you're automatically disqualified from the debate.
No boy.
So yeah, it's very important in that setting. And I get caught back up in it as opposed to what we do, which is mostly just arguing.
Yeah.
But my whole thing that might hurt you here.
My whole thing about writing into you guys, writing into Jack's Grown Up, was that you gave your direct opinion on saying, I think that these are necessary. And I said, I want to challenge your opinion. And you were like, No. I'm going to pull up the facts. I'm like, no. I want to hear what you have to say personally. Tell me why you didn't think that.
Marcus, let me turn to you. And thank you again for being here. So I'm curious to hear your takeaway from this. Did we change any of your hard felt opinions or sway you at all? What's kind of your feelings coming out the back end of these debates?
So Dana is intimidating. I say that off the
bat. Should I take that as a compliment?
You should.
Yes.
Okay.
Because I'm going to say, had she given the argument, I may have been swayed a bit.
Ooh, you should have put me in. Why didn't you call me in?
Another missed opportunity.
There you go. Call me in, coach. I think I could have done better than George on some of them too, but I'm not putting down either you or George. I think you did a good job. I enjoyed this very much. I don't think I was, again, I think if I was swayed at all, it was in the last 2 or 3 minutes. But I think because we're older and I've got a sense of dread about a lot of things anyway, because I've got dreadful things going on in my real life. So I think that constant dread thing is not super impactful on me in general. So I think that's why the jump scare thing is an important part to me. Yeah.
Maybe we can compromise because I think what I hear Dana and John saying are that, especially nowadays, jump scares are oftentimes belittling to our intellect and they're overused.
Overused, certainly. Yeah. I think a lot of us agree it's overused, right?
Yes.
I heard many people say
so
that.
So maybe it's that good jump scares are essential to horror as opposed to just jump scares in general, because I'll completely admit that there are plenty of times when I'm like, oh shit, here it comes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah. I see the little creepy person. Yeah. Okay. And because you've had so much experience watching horror films, the anticipation you have is not a fearful anticipation. It's anticipation of, here, I'm going to see the same shit over again.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when something does catch you off guard and really jolt you just a little bit, that's the thing, like Rachel was talking about. She remembers that one jump scare.
Mm-hmm. One good one.
The car in Hill House. Yeah. You didn't see it coming. Yeah. They're fighting with each other. And then all of a sudden you're like, holy crap.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like that with horror movies, if they have that one thing, I still go back to a terrible horror film, worst horror film of all time, maybe, Sleepaway Camp.
Yep. We talked about that one.
Right?
Yeah.
The ending scene of that one where the killer is standing up and the reveal, you know, like the Crying Game type of reveal happens with that character. Oh, still to this day, I can't get that out of my head. Terrible movie, but.
But you remember that.
That scene's going to stick with me.
Remember that shocking moment. Yep.
I think it could just be a lot of this. Maybe we are a product of our time. I think that, you know, Marcus and George may have grown up with a lot of those jump scares being essential in horror, especially when horror was really starting to rise up. And so that may be why they are more partial to those jump scares being a necessity in horror versus somebody like me who has really only started watching horror since, you know, early 2000s. And horror has definitely migrated into something very different. It's branched off in various different ways. And so I see that set as a lot of the standard. I've watched some older horror. I can admit I've watched Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th. I've watched a lot of those, even the crossover ones like Freddy versus Jason. But it doesn't ever have the same kind of infliction that I feel a lot of the newer stuff has. And so I set my bases off of that, whereas you guys may think differently.
I think you're right.
I knew I was going to get okay boomered, by the way.
Oh my God.
No, we came up with CGI being more of a thing and things looking a little more realistic or excessively unrealistic, you know?
Right.
I mean, at the time, I thought Robert Englund's performance in Nightmare on Elm Street was groundbreaking for bad guys in horror films. I hadn't seen anything like that. Now, with hindsight being 2020 and all, maybe it wasn't the greatest bad guy performance in horror films, but I think you're right, Dana, that I still hold on to that nostalgia of seeing it in the time.
It's something that can just be keystones for horror. Halloween is a keystone in horror. That's why it's still going to this day, because it has made itself a landmark in the franchise. And so people like Robert Englund may have that The Shining has a special port in that. There's a lot of things that just horror cannot get rid of over time. Those things are staples of the community that it's built.
Yeah.
Wow. Fascinating stuff. And a fun little debate here on the tail end. This was as intriguing to me as the rest of the debates, honestly. Just to kind of get that takeaway. Before we wind up this backtrack, I do have to take just a quick second to thank a brand new patron who started supporting us just recently. Patrick M. just hooked us up at that $3 level over on Patreon. Thank you so much. We appreciate you and so many of our patrons, many of them present on this call today. Thank you so much on the show. We are so grateful for your contributions. You really put gas in the tank and keep us going, doing what we do here on the show and over on YouTube and on the website. So, so grateful to each and every one of you, whether it be over on Patreon or over a member on YouTube. So, so, so grateful. That is going to wind it up for this edition of the Gen X Grown Up Backtrack. We'll be back in 2 more weeks with a new one, but next week's a regular edition of our show. Until then, I am John. Dana, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. You surely have not seen the last of me.
That had an ominous ring to it.
No, it's because she's in the other room.
Hang on. I can go over to John's real quick. It's okay.
Marcus, great to have you on the show. Thanks, man.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Rachel, we're always grateful for everything you do at GXG, and thank you for being here on the pod.
I get to keep my job. Yay!
George, as always, thanks so much.
Yes, sir.
Mo, you know I appreciate you, buddy.
Oh, man, always fun.
Fourth listener, it is you, though, we all appreciate most of all. And we will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
See you guys.
Take care, everybody.
No life, no fun. Don't you know that you're a grown-up?
Gen X Grown-Up is a member of the Evergreen Podcast family. Learn more at evergreenpodcasts.com.
No more washing shows till sunrise. Unacceptable for grown-ups. Your dinner cannot just be french fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown-up.
I'm so sorry. I'm so very sorry.
It's okay. You can start again. It gets edited. That's all
Thank
right.
God.
Yeah. That's all right. Oh, we do a blooper reel, just so you know. Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
That's awesome.
What was it like to be there for historical sports moments and unforgettable performances? To be behind the scenes? On Pressbox Access, you'll hear from me, Todd Jones, and other sports writers about their experiences with the greatest athletes, coaches, and sports events of the past half century. We'll share some stories behind the stories, some big, some small, and some we've only told each other. Let us buy you a round on Pressbox Access.